And now we're going to go on, if you look on your outline, on page 15b, how to practice the last two far-reaching attitudes in particular. So here we have, you know, the first one, you know, training in calm abiding in order to perfect meditative stabilization. So meditative stabilization is the far-reaching attitude, but we're going to train in calm abiding in order to perfect that. And then the second point was training in special insight to perfect the wisdom of emptiness. So the wisdom is the sixth far-reaching attitude, and we train in special insight in order to do that. Okay, so here we get into the teachings on calm abiding. So, okay, so in the Galupa tradition, particularly, they combined two major presentations from Indian commentaries when they gave these teachings on calm abiding. So one presentation was from Maitreya and his text Uttanamche, which is an incredibly beautiful text. And here he discusses the five faults, or the five hindrances, and then the eight antidotes, how to correct them in order to develop calm abiding. And then the second major Indian presentation was from a Sangha, his Sravaka Bhumi and Compendium of Knowledge, and also Maitreya Sutra Alankara. And he describes the nine mental abidings, the nine states until we get to calm abiding. We'll be going through this as time goes on. And the six powers and the four mental engagements. And these two kind of presentations in the ancient Indian scriptures were put together by the Kadampas. When Atisha came from India to Tibet, the tradition that descended from him was the Kadampa tradition, and so these Kadampa Geshes put together these two Indian presentations. And they also included material from Kamala Sila and Harivadra, Asanga, and so forth. And so they really emphasized that it's very good for us to study the Indian commentaries on calm abiding, or to study the Tibetan syntheses of the Indian commentaries, because they go into a lot of detail, and if we can understand this material well, then when we sit down to meditate, we'll be able to do it quite effectively. Because these teachings talk about all the different mental factors, not that you need, not all the mental factors, but the mental factors that you need to abandon to develop calm abiding, and which, how you abandon them, and then the mental factors that we need to develop, and particularly in order to develop calm abiding and be able to concentrate our mind. So it's quite psychological, because in talking about these mental factors, it's pointing out different aspects of our own mind. And so we hear the teachings and gain some kind of intellectual understanding, but then the key is when we sit and meditate and try and develop some concentration to find these same mental factors in our own mind. You know, so when it talks about excitement, well, what does excitement look like in me? When excitement arises in my mind, what do I feel like? What's going on? And what is mindfulness? You know, when I am mindful, what is my mind doing when it's mindful? Okay, when I have introspective alertness, what is it? You know, what is my mind doing? And so it's, you know, if we learn all these things and then apply them in our meditation, then it gives us a lot of tools and skills to really concentrate. And it's quite curious, you know, because I think study is important to help us in our meditation. You know, and His Holiness is always emphasizing this. I mentioned it last week, you know, that some people think meditation's here and study is here, and they're two different things. And if you study, you become an intellectual and you're dry. And if you meditate, you get some experience. But His Holiness really emphasizes, you know, if you study and you become a dry intellectual, that's your problem. But that's not why you study. That's not the purpose of the study. The purpose is to learn the things so that you can become your meditation can go ahead really well and really effectively. And I think this is real important, especially, you know, when you kind of look around and, you know, everybody's meditating these days. But you ask them, what are they meditating on? And it's like, you know, kind of, well, the guy next door made up a meditation and I'm doing it. Yeah, or I made up a meditation, or meditation means sit and imagine, you know, myself being very successful with everything I want around me. You know, that's meditation, how to increase attachment. Yeah? So that's why I think it's really important to get instructions about exactly what meditation is, so that when we do it right. Otherwise, we waste a whole lot of time. You know, we just waste years and lifetimes, quote-unquote meditating, but not really getting anywhere. You know, so that's why this kind of learning this is really important. And I've been reading Genla's book on it too, and, you know, he emphasizes the very same thing. And you look at Genla, and Genla is no dry intellectual, you know. You know, you can really see the teachings in his life. And yet, you know, he tells his students, you know, it's good to study these texts and learn these things. Genla's book, by the way, is excellent. It's really nicely done, you know. It's quite wonderful. Shamatha meditation. Yeah. Okay, so to generate, I wanted to tell you the etymology of calm abiding, how it got that name. Because the calm abiding, I remember when I wrote Open Heart, Clear Mind, and I sent the manuscript in to be edited, and the editor kept circling calm abiding. What kind of English is this? Calm abiding, you know? This isn't English. This is some weird language. And I said, it's a technical term. She said, can't you find another one? So the Tibetan term is, for shamatha is the Sanskrit term. The Tibetan term is jine. Ji means calm or peace. And ne means to abide or to stay or to rest or to remain. Okay? So the mind is abiding on an internal object of observation. Okay? So it's abiding, when it talks about an internal object, it's an object of the mental consciousness. The mind is not directed outside towards something. Okay? It's not abiding on chocolate cake. It's abiding on an internal object of meditation. And it's calm because it has calm, it's calmed from running to the external objects. Okay? So it's calm means that it's calmed down from running to external objects. You know, when you sit and do the breathing meditation, the mind's at work, it's at home, it's in Tahiti, it's everywhere else. Okay, it's not calm. Yeah, it's traveling. So calm abiding, that mind is calm. It's calm from the external objects, and then it's abiding on an internal object. For example, the image of the Buddha or whatever, you know, the breath or whatever your object of meditation is. It's external. It is a physical object, but at a certain point it becomes a mental object because you concentrate and you start getting images, and that the image becomes the object you develop calm abiding on. Not necessarily images, but internal is an object of mental consciousness. Yeah. Okay. So we don't develop calm abiding by staring at a candle. Okay. Or we don't, you know, or for example, if we use as the object of meditation the image of the Buddha, we might look at the picture quite a long time and, you know, to really like learn the details of what the Buddha looks like. But just staring at the picture is not how we're going to get calm abiding. You know, what we have to do is, you know, lower the eyes and be able to recreate that image in our mind and hold our mind on the internal object.
That seems to be a very important distinction.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's quite important. Because again, you look at a lot of the New Age meditations and, you know, staring at candles and things like that. So.
Have you ever had long arguments with Karen and Copan about if Buddha was empty and a potato was empty, what would be the difference between Buddha or between a potato, which in this case is an internal object, could also be a chocolate cake.
Yeah, right. But when you think of chocolate cake, what effect does it have on your mind versus when you think of the Buddha? They have different effects on your mind, just the image. I mean, even, you know, when you look at the figure of the Buddha, I mean, we're all crazy and going bananas and Buddha's just, you know, I mean, just these long, narrow, compassionate eyes, completely still. So even we imagine that in our mind's eye, it has a psychological effect of, you know, bringing the mind down and really generating a lot of faith. If we hold the image of chocolate cake in our mind, it's going to generate a whole lot of energy to go up, get off the meditation cushion and go get it. But then it's also going to be hard to concentrate on the image of chocolate cake, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be, like another image object that I would choose.
Yeah, but if you, for example, use the figure of the Buddha, that object is very pleasing, and the more you look at it, the more you want to look at it. So then, you know, to sit and concentrate on that is refreshing. Okay, now to generate calm abiding, it's important to have prerequisite factors during the beginning, the middle, and the end of our practice. Now, if the external and internal conditions, which I'll describe in a minute, if they're good, you know, if you have all of them together, then developing calm abiding becomes quite easy. And some people say you can even do it within 6 months if you have all the external and internal conditions. On the other hand, if we don't have these conditions, then even we try and meditate for years and years and years, it's going to be difficult to gain the realizations. Now, in our workaday life, it's virtually impossible to have all of the even external conditions for developing calm abiding. So this is kind of a practice that to reach its completion, we do really it in a much more, in a retreat situation, not just in a session before you go to work and a session when you come home. But what we can do is we can do, because I was saying before that there's 9 stages before you get to full calm abiding, we can work on some of these initial stages, you know, like first, second, third ones. Those we can work on even we're living in the city and have a busy life. And we can make progress on those, and that still is quite valuable because our mind will start getting calmer and more concentrated. You know? And then by doing that, then later when we go in a retreat situation and get all the conditions together, we'll have some training behind us so it becomes easier. Okay, so I'm going to just describe those in a minute. But one other point. Calm abiding is a type of meditation, okay? Because it's one in which it's called stabilizing or absorption meditation, because the purpose of it is to get the mind to stay single-pointedly on an object. In fact, let me give you the definition of calm abiding from Lam Rim Chenmo, okay? It's a samadhi accompanied by a joy of mental and physical pliancy. These terms will be explained as we go on. In which the mind abides naturally, without effort, for as long as one wishes, without fluctuation, on whichever virtuous object it has been placed. Okay, so Samadhi, or sometimes it's translated as concentration, is a mental factor that we have now at the present. Okay? So we usually think of samadhi as, you know, when you're single-pointedly, you know, undisturbed, so that even a cannon goes off beside you, you don't move. We usually think of that as samadhi. Actually, samadhi is one mental factor that we have right now. You know? the ability to concentrate. It's not very well developed in us right now, but we have samadhi right now, and the thing is what we want to do is develop it and develop it and develop it and make it stronger and enriched till it gets to be, you know, the state of calm abiding. And even beyond, there's other states of concentration beyond calm abiding. Okay, so calm abiding is a type of meditation, and it can be a prerequisite for other kinds of meditation. And you do it in combination. You know, after you have calm abiding, for example, then if you meditate on love, but you meditate on love with calm abiding, then your meditation on love becomes really, really powerful because your mind has the ability to stay on the virtuous object as long as it wants to. So you turn it to love and your concentration's right there and your meditation on love goes really, really well. Or you turn your calm abiding mind and you use it to meditate on emptiness and, you know, you're able to stay on the object of emptiness. So you turn your mind of calm abiding to the relative nature of mind, the clear light, the clear and knowing nature of mind. And it's able to stay on that. Okay? So calm abiding is like a talent or a skill that you can use in many, many different ways. You can use it in many, many different kinds of, together with many, many different things. Are people getting this? Okay? Good. So you can meditate on love without calm abiding. You can meditate on love with calm abiding. There's going to be a big difference between the two. You can do tantric practice without calm abiding. You can do tantric practice with calm abiding. Again, there's going to be a difference between when you do. So that's why it's really quite beneficial for us to develop calm abiding. Calm abiding is something that is also common with non-Buddhist traditions. In other words, this ability to have this kind of samadhi that is, you know, together with pliancy that's able to stay on the object, this is not a quality or an ability that only Buddhists have. So I think Hindus have it. I think some Christians can have it. You know, anybody can have it as long as they have the method and the technique to develop it. So it's not unique to Buddhism. In fact, you see in a lot of the Buddhist scriptures, they talk a lot about this because they say that a lot of Hindu sages of old, they developed very strong calm abiding, but they mistook that for liberation from cyclic existence. Yeah? And so Buddhism is very strict on this point, saying, no, calm abiding itself alone isn't what liberates you. We need to conjoin it with the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Otherwise, we can't get liberated. Okay, but so many people, because it's so blissful when you develop calm abiding, they may mistake it for actual liberation when it isn't. Okay, so it's something in common with non-Buddhist traditions. But the difference when a Buddhist does it and when a non-Buddhist does it is when a Buddhist does this practice, it's conjoined with refuge in the triple gem. It's conjoined with the determination to free ourselves from cyclic existence. And especially when somebody on the Mahayana path practices it, it's conjoined with the wish to become a Buddha for the benefit of others. So you can see that, you know, these other conjoining attitudes are going to make a big difference in what the calm abiding turns out to be. You know, if you have very firm refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and you develop calm abiding, you're going to do something with it completely different than if you don't have refuge. Same if you have the determination to be free, how you use the calm abiding. Even the strength of mind that you have to do the meditation, to develop calm abiding, if you have the determination to be free, it's going to be much easier to get yourself to the cushion to meditate than if you don't have it. You know, same with the bodhicitta. If we have at least some feeling for bodhicitta, that kind of motivation, that's going to help us attain calm abiding easier. And after we've attained calm abiding, we'll use it in accordance with the motivation of bodhicitta. So it's going to kind of be used in a different way. You see the difference there? It's actually, I think, quite interesting and very important. you know. It's like a credit card is common to this person and that person, but depending upon the person's motivation, they're going to use the credit card really differently. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the Tibetan master seems, you know, especially to us, those of us at the beginning, they don't emphasize that we sit and develop calm abiding right away and go from stage 1 to stage 9 and then beyond that to calm abiding at the beginning of the practice. They feel that for us, it's very important that we get a whole broad general understanding of the path and a real life view that applies to a philosophy that applies to every single aspect of our life. And so that's why I think especially they emphasize the analytic meditation for us. That this doesn't mean neglecting calm abiding, because it's very good if we develop some ability to concentrate. But rather than just do calm abiding meditation, because in order to like really actualize calm abiding meditation, you have to just do that. You can't do anything else. You can't watch TV. You can't go to work. You can't, you know, if you're just going to go for calm abiding right away. Also, it requires a lot of purification and a great deal of collection of merit to do it. And so if we don't have that, we're going to run into all sorts of obstacles when we're trying to meditate on calm abiding. Okay? So this is why the Tibetan Lamas really emphasize to us, you know, do a lot of purification, do a lot of practices to collect positive potential. Hear the teachings and then reflect on them and meditate on them. Try and develop some determination to be free. Develop an understanding of refuge. Develop bodhicitta. Develop some understanding of emptiness. Because if you have a really good overall view of the entire Lam Rim, then you know how to put your life together. You know, things happen in your life and you have a way to understand what's happening in your life. Whereas if you don't get this whole broad understanding of the path and you just go for one particular kind of meditation right away, then you tend to see this real big gap between your meditation and your life. And things happen in your life and you don't know how to put it together, because all you know is, you know, how to sit on your cushion, but that has nothing to do with your life. Okay? So that's why they really, you know, do a lot of the analytic meditation with us. Yeah? That we have a really broad encompassing life view. And I know for me personally, I really needed that. Yeah? If I had come into Buddhism and they said, okay, just watch your breath, I probably would have left after a couple of days. Yeah? Because I needed to learn how to put my life together, how to understand my own mind and what was happening. I think that's really the beauty of the Lam Rim teaching. Yeah. So that's the Tibetan approach. Other traditions do it quite differently. Okay. You know the meditation outlines I prepared, like at the Cloud Mountain Retreat? That was to help people like learn how to do the analytic meditation. You know, think about this point, then think about this point. And the key to all of them is thinking about them in relationship to your own life. And making it, and it's a meditation where you're thinking, you're contemplating, and you're kind of like mulling. There's a few ways to do it. One is just mull this point over in your mind. You know, like you take the death meditation, first point, death is definite. Mull that over in your mind, you know, or think of many examples of it. Or one person told me what they do is they pretend that they were trying to describe that point to their mother, you know. How do you describe that to your friend or to your mother? And so you kind of think about it in that way. And in the process of doing that, you come to understand in a deeper way what it's really about. It's not just saying the words, you know. It's making an example. Okay? So if we do the analytic meditation, we go step by step in thinking about these. And then you can see that all the analytic meditations are designed to help us gain some kind of conclusion or some kind of experience. And the conclusion isn't just, oh yes, death is definite, time of death is indefinite, only thing is important. It's dharma, when you die, I dedicate all the merits. Yes, you know, it's not that kind of conclusion. But It's like, you know, when you really get a feeling like, death is different, I'm going to die, I'm going to leave this body. What is that? You know, what does that feel like in me to know that someday I'm going to leave this body? What does it feel like for me to know that someday people will talk about Trupchen Trishan, but I won't be around? Yeah, my mind will be born somewhere else. Or that I'm going to leave all this. You know, here I create this wonderful, fantastic ego identity to know, you know, one day, boing, it's gone. Yeah, I'm not going to be American anymore. I'm not going to be a woman. I'm not going to be 5'4". I'm not going to be this. I'm not going to be that. It's all going to go. What is that, you know, what does that make me feel like inside? What's my understanding? And you know, the conclusion, it isn't just a dry intellectual one. It's like some change in feeling in your heart happens. And then you stay. Yeah? And then you stay kind of single-pointed on that. Or if you meditate on precious human life, okay, you're not going to get angry. I mean, you have to look at your anxiety and make sure if you're meditating properly on death, too. Okay? But, you know, you meditate on precious human life, and so you look at the thing. Well, I could have been born as an animal. What would that be like? What would it be like to be a challa? You know? I mean, if I were born as a challa, how could I practice the Dharma? And you really, you know, you pretend to be like that. I mean, what's going on in his mind all day? Yeah? I mean, he's in this incredible Dharma environment. Yeah?
And for you to know another one,
please. That's why it can be very helpful before you do the analytic meditation, number one, to do some prayers and to do some breathing meditation. Because you do the breathing and you start to let go of the jabbering mind. So that then when you do the analytic meditation, you aren't jabbering the points to yourself, but there's some kind of deliberateness. Deliberateness? You know, to the way you're thinking about it. What's the benefit of doing it on your cushion versus doing it on the highway or in the gym or something like that? Well, I think sometimes when you're on the cushion, you can concentrate better. This isn't to say don't think about these things on the highway. Think about them on the highway as much as you can, everywhere you go. But the thing is, when you're on the highway, you also have to pay attention to the cars. And so your mind can't be as concentrated. Okay, so that's why we try and do it on the cushion, too. When you're doing it in the car? American meditation. Yeah. I mean, for example, you know, if you put a tape in, this is what Cindy does. You know, she puts the tape on and she listens to it on her way to work and she thinks about these things and she tells me she turns the tape off and she'll sit and think about the things for a while and then she'll turn the tape on and continue. You know, so it's really good. Remember we were talking about hearing reflection meditating? That's the reflection one. Okay, hearing the things and then turn the tape off and you think about it for a while. Even you're driving the car, that's okay. Or you talk about it with your friends. Yeah. Even sometimes our meditation is more reflection than it is real meditation. Because sometimes just in our meditation, we're just trying to understand it. Yeah? Make sure we got the concept right, get some general understanding. And then meditation is when we really begin to sink the mind into it. And experience starts to come.